Hello.
Hey, Jason.
Jesse.
Cool, man. How you feeling this morning?
Well, that's a loaded question.
No, you want to unpack it at all, or you want to just proceed?
Well, yeah, I'm disintegrating nicely. How about you?
I'll be honest, man. I'm fighting and I'm scared, and the only thing that I really enjoy anymore is crying and sleeping and writing songs. That's about it.
Well, at least you're creative in the midst of your crisis, then.
Yeah, but I feel like I feel like it's all moving furniture around on the sinking ship, you know?
Yeah, I know what you mean.
And so, then the question is, what to do with myself, and then, what is myself?
Right. Well. So, if you're in the shallow, I mean, the doing is all in the shallow, isn't it? Really, this notion of free will, I think it only extends. It stays in the shallow, really. If we try to extend it into the deeper realms of our being, then there really isn't. It's really not a factor as far as deciding what to do. It's, I think we only get to decide how honest we're willing to be when we're in the midst of stuff. That seems to be the only factor that really makes much of a difference. I mean, I've been in a difficult period lately. I mean, it's been going on, of course, for years. But when I cast my mind back, it always ends up extending back for years, but it's been particularly bad in the last couple of days, let's say, or particularly difficult. And it's staying in that knowing that something's happening that doesn't require my input. You know, I don't actually have to do anything in order to facilitate the process of disintegration, but the more honest I'm able to be in while I'm in that process with myself, the easier it is to stay in what I know, because it's dishonesty that takes us out of what we know, because then we're investing in a false interpretation. You know, we're trying to spin it in such a way that there's something in it for us, and we can come out somehow looking good. And that's if we're invested just in that, in looking good, and you know, coming out in some way that's a benefit to us, then it's like I guess like your analogy, really. We're busy rearranging the furniture while the ship sinks, so that the ship is going to look good when it goes under, and it really doesn't matter. Yeah,
Yeah.
we're having to be dishonest, aren't we? Because with the ship sinking, so why the hell are we rearranging furniture?
Yeah, I suppose I then wonder the futility in looking for a life raft, because even that is kind of rooted in my self-preservation instincts. I mean, there's so many places to go. I suppose, my third and fourth Salvia Divinorum experiences really unhinged me. And when I saw Being the One, which I saw after months of listening to Stormy Weather, I really identified with that guy who was screaming after he took the red pill. And I basically had an experience the third time I smoked salvia. I'd say it was about 2 years ago, and pretty much instantly, it all started to, that pressing sensation of kind of a fractal energy vortex that I was getting kind of chewed up and sucked into, but meanwhile being pulled into this wheel of entities. And for I guess my interpretation of those entities was they were my siblings and my mom and dad. And they were very adamantly trying to tell me that I was stuck in a dream of like a very small portion of reality, and that it's time to wake up. And, you know, so I'm reaching for things in the room to, like, pull me back into the material world. And so ever since then, and then a very similar kind of repeat of that experience, I've just been trying to come to terms with surrender and, you know, kind of being torn between a false dichotomy of, like, sorcery versus surrender. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, actually, but just bringing it back, first of all, you said you went back, you say you had that intense experience on Salvia and then you revisited Salvia afterwards?
I did, man. I put about, I don't know, 6 or 8 months between the two experiences, and I really wanted to, like, be able to let go fully and fully die the second time, and I still wasn't able to, man. I really, really was just holding on, so afraid. Like, what about me?
Right, but so why were you trying to die?
Yeah, it's kind of, there's a, I suppose, an irony to trying to do something that can't be tried.
Well, but why do you want to be awakened or unplugged? Or, you know?
I don't know. I suppose I sense a fuller embodiment of myself in...
But why would you want a fuller embodiment of yourself? Isn't life hard enough?
Yeah, isn't life hard enough? I suppose I make an assumption that it is less hard being the fuller expression of myself. Somehow there's a freedom and an ease that comes with it. And, you know, that's just an assumption.
Yeah. Yeah. Is it based on any experience?
Well, there was a mushroom trip that I had after the two Salvia experiences where, I mean, it was just, it took me, man, and there was no fighting, and I was like, okay, you know, I'm in for it this time. And I had to ask myself the question, you know, what am I afraid of? And I asked it out loud, and I really thought about it, and I couldn't come up with anything. I sat there and I said, I don't know. And in that accepting of not knowing what I was afraid of, there was like a conquering of that identifying with the fear, and I was able to dissolve into an experience where, you know, my personal boundaries, like the lines of where I end and everything else begins, were just completely blurred. And I just laid there in bed for I don't know how long in this, you know, beautiful blanket of love. And of course I came out of it eventually. And and so I guess I'm trying to still integrate that. And, you know, I'm still alive. I'm still here. And so just kind of finding myself saying what to do and all making it about doing instead of just, you know, like, what does a kid do during a cosmic shift? I think a kid just, is a kid. And why can't I just be okay with not knowing and dissolving?
Mm-hmm. And just stay in the shallow and get on with your daily, day-to-day stuff. Because what the shift that's happening doesn't need our input. And the more we put our hands on it, the less it can happen through us. At best it happens to us is when we take psychedelics, and that always creates an imbalance, because we, you know, we attain these states through will. They're not true awakenings. The closest I've come to a true awakening through psychedelics, through DMT, was with Mitch, and that was presumably because it was his idea. He was acting as a shaman, as a vessel for the divine, and I put my trust in him, and I didn't want to smoke that DMT, so I had to surrender to do it, and it was annihilating, and it was terrifying. And but the vision that I had, I think, was the clearest and cleanest vision I've had of a, you know, whatever you want to call that, transhuman state of consciousness. And so I would kind of single that out in my psychedelic experiences perhaps as being the one time that the awakening was closer to to a true awakening, presumably for that reason, that I didn't put my hands on it and do it for myself. Now, I was doing salvia a lot, as you've presumably gathered. I've talked about it with Neil, I think, on one of the Stormy Weathers. I was doing it every week for a few months.
That's brave, man. I couldn't do that.
Well, it's not really great. That's the point. You know, at the end of that time, I ended up with 6 cavities and God only knows what other sort of damage to my nervous system from accelerating that awakening. But, you know, I was always afraid to do salvia, but I pushed myself to do it because I felt like it was necessary in some way. And while you were talking, one experience that I had came to mind, which was when I found myself in this state of what seemed like total freedom after the hit of salvia, and I was prowling around the house in a state of ecstasy, you might say, or just this power flowing through me, and I was aware of being I experienced it as being this opening, if you will, in space-time, and all these consciousness was just flowing through me. It was a multitude of consciousnesses which seemed to be like allies and gods and angels and demons and whatever, just all of these consciousnesses were just flowing through me. And I was just the gateway through which they were emerging into the world, if you will. And but my experience was just being this body in this state of ecstasy and total freedom. But as I was prowling around the house, like enjoying this feeling of total power and total freedom, I kind of detected in my consciousness an area of fear, and I as consciousness, because I had no sense of a self at this point, was curious, like, what's that? That's fear, what is it? And so I zeroed in on the fear to see what it was, and I as consciousness discovered that the fear was a fear of remembering my identity. I was afraid that I would remember who I was and lose this incredible freedom and power. And as soon as I saw that, I don't know if I actually laughed, but I felt this sort of laughter in me and these voices saying, no, that's Jake. No, Jake's okay. We love Jake. Don't worry about that. So, like, my personal self was in there, and it was accepted and embraced by that consciousness. But there was an element of fear, there was association of fear for me as consciousness, because I had been trapped in that identity before, and so I felt like I felt some, whether it was in my body or just like a memory imprint of as consciousness, like, don't go there. If you go back to Jake, you'll get stuck again.
Stuck is a great word. I kind of got into my spiritual path through early LSD experiences, way too young in my opinion now, but, you know, around 15 or 16, I remember, you know, my friend in one LSD trip saying, man, we're stuck, man, we're stuck. Or at least he was saying, I'm stuck. And that seems to be a word that comes up a lot, because I feel like I'm stuck here and like I'm living a lie. But it's
not you. I mean, the stuckness is the position of the assemblage point.
Okay.
And so you're stuck on one bandwidth, and you don't know how to get off that bandwidth to tune into other bandwidths and to have a wider spectrum of consciousness, therefore a wider experience of yourself as consciousness and of reality. But that's habitual. The assemblage point gets stuck in that position, on that bandwidth, because it's just been there so long that it's dug a groove, and now it's stuck in that groove. And so then we use psychedelic to push it out of that groove, and then it moves freely, and we experience these other bandwidths of consciousness, and we think, wow, you know, that this is so cool, this is so groovy, you know, I don't want to get stuck back in that old tunnel, why do I have to go back there? But the reason I tell that story myself was because it illustrated that I hadn't let go of my own attachment to a need for an awakening, Therefore, there was fear. You see, if I'd been totally okay with going back to being Jake and being stuck as Jake forever, then I wouldn't have had to get pulled back. It was the fear itself that pulled me back, because it was the fear that had driven me to smoke the salvia and to get out of that stuckness to begin with.
Yeah.
So as long as there's that element of fear, then we're not being honest about what we know as consciousness, which is that we don't need an awakening. We don't need, like, to get out of this stuckness, because that greater band of consciousness, or that greater field of consciousness, is actually experiencing itself now. It's just that we're not tuning into the data, but it's happening. We are already there. You know, we're just not picking up all of that information now. So, and that's for a reason. It's not a reason necessary that we can flatten out into words without, you know, sounding New Age cliche, but whatever, you know, we've chosen to be in a state of forgetting for a period of time. And another thing, see, that was coming to me when you were talking, when you brought up psychedelics, that's related, is that for all those times that I used psychedelics to get out of my constructed identity and to see beyond it, they took their toll, not just physically, but in terms of it being much harder thereafter to return to that narrow band of awareness and stay in it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, once I stopped doing psychedelics, because I just knew that I was abusing them and that they were doing harm to my body and all the rest of it, I didn't have the terminology or the understanding that I have now. But whenever it was, back in 2001 was pretty much when I stopped doing psychedelics. I think I've done one mushroom trip since then and some marijuana, really. But that was... there was a certain amount of understanding, but mostly it was instinctive. And then in the period since then, I've realized that basically I've just been paying taxes, really, on all of those experiences of investing in my own awakening. It's like the backlash is, well, here I am. Now it's doubly hard to be stuck in this narrow tunnel of awareness because I've seen what's outside of it.
Yeah.
But I don't have any better idea of how to get to that state. All I know is what it's like. And how many times do you really need to see what that state is like? That's the question. And I would say not many, really.
Yeah, I would tend to agree. You know, it's I have a keen awareness of just the basic work that I need to be doing to empty myself, just sitting and breathing and my avoidance of that, and psychedelics being a really harsh, confrontational, not even proper substitution for just being okay with being and letting go. And so I'll sit at work and I'll, you know, listen to podcasts and music that, you know, that makes me cry and brings me to my heart, and I see my avoidance of dealing with my pain and my patterns and just kind of living out the patterns and beginning to identify them through my projections onto you and listening to your podcasts and you know, wanting in the past to bring up things to my mom and you know, really touched a nerve when you said, you know, how it's easy for a parent to take it as a personal attack as opposed to just hearing where their child's coming from and separating their need to protect that part of themselves that lives in the denial of the pain they've caused. And so, you know, now I'm a parent and I have two kids and, you know, my wife and I split up 6 months ago and I pretty much feel lost, bro. And, I'm trying to become okay with just being lost.
How old are you?
28.
Saturn return.
Amen.
Hmm.
and I'm going through a heavy, heavy death rebirth motif that I guess you asked earlier, you know, why do you feel the need to force your death? And I don't know, man. I don't know why. I guess like this hypercritical tendency of, like, you know, an awareness of the illusion and then cutting myself down for participating in the illusion.
But why complicate it?
Yeah.
If you're really honest, then you know why. You're trying to force your death or force your awakening. It's because you're tired of suffering. Mm. You want pain relief. That's the only reason we do anything, really.
Yeah, that's why I smoke weed every day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's like, I definitely have all these false comforts that I turn to, and
well, even the connecting to your heart center by listening to sappy songs. I mean, that's something that I did as a kid. I even made a whole bunch of tapes called Soppy Love Songs, which was my kind of deflective thing, because I was, you know, there was a lot of sentimental stuff on there, Lionel Richie and God knows what else, but there was also, you know, some really good stuff. But essentially, I was being honest about what I was doing then, which I compiled these tapes that I could put on and cry to. And that was very cathartic to me. And to this day, I still do have CDs of songs to cry to, actually. I just don't call them sappy love songs. But I've kind of become aware in the last few months that even that becomes unclean. Anything that we put our hands on becomes unclean. Because, I mean, why do I need to break down? Why do I need to open my heart? Why do I need to connect to that sorrow? It's like, we don't need any of this, really, for ourselves. All we need to do is just be honest about what is, what's going on. And that's not a doing, is it? That's a perceiving, that's an allowing. So it's just like, the less we engage with doing anything about changing the situation we're in, or inner or outer, then the closer we are to surrender. Because honesty, let's say, it's not a doing, it's a letting in. And so as long as we're actually trying to change something outside us or within us, our mood or our circumstances, then we're too busy, like, fixing it to just look at it.
Yeah.
Like a doctor to diagnose, he doesn't start, you know, prescribing. Well, they do these days, of course, that's the point. But a real shaman, a real healer, doesn't actually do anything, I don't think. I think it would just be a question of tuning in to the body and becoming aware of that condition. And once it comes fully into consciousness, then it begins to shift. It's like, it's the suppression of stuff, which is the result of our insistence on seeing things our way. That's what creates the blockage, and that's what creates the pain and the disease and all the rest of it. So the doing is actually a way not to let something in, always.
Can I ask you, when you're in a space where you feel like you are open and, you know, creating that space as a vessel, as you often say, and you let it in and aren't being dishonest or trying to put your hands on it. For me, in those kinds of spaces, I find that inspiration often comes, and it's almost like I let it take me, you know, and so I'll, instead of maintaining that space, the space fosters, you know, inspiration for a song. And so I'll jump on the song train and start writing a song. And it's not that the writing of the song takes me out of that, but it kind of does, because then I go into this analytical, you know, I'm a songwriter, and I'm, you know, even though it's one of the purest things that I do, it still reeks of, you know, of wanting to be a somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And so in terms of, like, you know, I hear myself being so hung up on, you know, the doing part, and I hear that, but at the same time, so much of just getting through life consists of of making decisions, and I feel like incapable of making decisions because of the doing or the thing that will result as the result of making a choice. Does that make any sense?
Well, sort of. I mean,
yeah, it's kind of convoluted.
I could fill in the gaps because I mean, you've listened to Ezra and I talking, and so you would have tuned into Ezra's crisis to some extent, and it's he was the first person to graduate from Sweater to give me an idea of what graduation would entail, because Sweater, Ezra kind of lost his will to live. He let in the virus to the extent that he was kind of paralyzed by it, and he realized that he had to leave Sweater because that was giving him a reason to live too. And so that was like the perfect paradox of that he had attained this seeing that constituted graduation. He was willing to let go of the very system that was showing him the need to let go. And so that was total at that point. But his experience of it, and that was the proof of it to me, was just losing his will to live. And so he was wrestling with what I think that you were trying to describe there. It's like, how do you let go of personal agendas and those deeper goals and drives and still eat and wash and brush your teeth? And it's a very vital question, but it's not for the intellect.
Right.
It's just something that we have to go through, Jesse, because I mean, like last few weeks and even months really, I have had a hard time eating. I just haven't had much appetite. I'm underweight anyway, so it's not like I can really use this to my advantage. I really have to kind of force myself or tell myself to eat. Now, and so is that putting my hands on something? No, because the body actually does need food. And so, you know, external desires are very different from internal desires. There's nothing unclean about wanting to eat. But then when we use food as a way to feel good about ourselves, then we're putting our hands on it because we're mixing it up with some internal desire, which is bogus, which is dishonest. We don't need to eat nice food in order to be happy or to enjoy life. But we do need to eat food, and so there's nothing, no harm in preparing nice food and enjoying it. There's all the difference in the world, you see, between, even though it seems subtle, between enjoying what one does and doing things in order to enjoy something.
Right.
You know, using things as a doing of feel good.
Yeah, the pleasure button.
So when we let go of that, or when it starts falling away, then, and this is in Castaneda as well, Don Juan says to Cas at one point that a warrior's, the goal of a warrior is to have no wants, to want nothing, but you've ended up not liking anything. So you've gone a little too far, Carlos. And that's, you know, but that is a risk, because it's like if we don't want anything, then it creates this sort of state of neutrality, which is very close to indifference and apathy and lethargy and fuck. And it's the last stand of the ego, of the constructed identity, because when we start to see that there really is nothing in it for us, for our persons, then we want to say fuck it. I'm not going to eat. Why should I eat? There's nothing in it for me. Why should I keep this body alive? It's not even for me. It's not even mine. Nothing, you know. The only thing we get to do as persons is let go and clear up a space, you know, back down, get in our hammocks and fall asleep so that our true being can awaken. And actually, that's all we really want, if we're honest, is to get into the hammock and just fall asleep, to die, you know. But the constructed identity can't do that. It just, because it was constructed as a defense armor, it's all about doing, and it has to, you know, it just has to be active. Otherwise, it panics. So when we insist, you know, even though our body and our greater being knows that something's happening, that little part of us is insisting on doing something, in the end, the only thing that's left for it to do is try and sabotage, try and fuck it up. that's all that's left of insistence. So that's why you get the ultimate insistence is suicide,
Right.
which is of course a surrogate, for identity suicide, true suicide. So as long as you're in your identity, identifying with that personal self, you're seeing that you're dying and that you're actually even allowing a death to happen, then that can be confused with actual suicide. Like, oh, well, that's it. I've got no will to live. Then I might as well die, as in physical death. So and even if that isn't a conscious thing, like for me, suicide is not an option and never really has been. I think I've had just too deep a knowing about that, right? Which doesn't mean I don't have a lot of suicidal thoughts. I do, or I used to. But we can do it in subtle ways by sabotaging and by putting our hands on and it's I guess at a certain point it's like, for years it was always about all the stuff I shouldn't be doing and that I needed to be doing. It's probably how it feels for you.
Can you expand on that?
Well, just like the warrior's path, really. Like, am I being impeccable? Mm. Like you with the guitar. Not trusting my motives and just feeling like I wasn't disciplined enough or I was too indulgent. I shouldn't be watching so many movies. Well, that was just a constant thing.
Yeah, me too.
But I'm at a point now where it's a weird sort of conundrum, Jesse, because it's like, actually, it's worse to discipline myself or use effort or will to be impeccable than not to be impeccable.
Yeah.
So it's like, wait a minute, I'm off the hook then. I don't have to be impeccable either. The real impeccability is to go beyond impeccability or the need for it. Because that was it wasn't impeccable really, because I was investing in something. If I'm impeccable for long enough, I'll gather energy and I'll become a sorcerer and then I'll be able to unplug and then I'll be free and then my pain will be over. That was what it was. It was just a great big sophisticated sorcery carrot. So it was never really clean. So I was never able to really be impeccable, because impeccability is acting without thought of gain.
Yeah, I definitely have so many agendas, and in terms of, my heroes, they were all somebodies, whether it's John Lennon or Kurt Cobain or Brian Wilson. I mean, and I suppose the most insidious part of it is that it's my ego cloaks it in a veil of like spreading a message of love and truth. And so, let me be a a clean somebody, and it's oh boy.
Yeah, but it's there's no need to take it that seriously, because it's not like you're the only somebody out there who wants to be. It's a virus, and we've all got it, and it's, I don't know. Again, it's a doing if you're trying to stop doing as well. So it's just recognizing what is shallow as shallow,
right,
and recognizing what is deep as deep. And part of that recognition is that what is deep is beneath and beyond our conscious awareness, much less control. So whatever's going on there, and it doesn't matter how deep we go, there's always deeper to go. There's all the way into complete dissolution, nothingness, and that is true being to us,
Yeah.
So then stay in the shallow, but at the same time be aware of the deep, without forgetting that the deep is there. Because if we're trying to get into the shallow to get away from the deep, then that's just, a humaton. That's just what everybody's doing, and we know that doesn't work. We can't take the blue pill. But the red pill thing, you know, that it's not really a choice, is it?
I have a feeling they're both red pills. One just has food coloring.
Right. I mean, everybody's going the same way. Yeah. It's just how much kicking and screaming and just how long it takes for us to get there.
Well, it seems that consciousness wants to be expressed in an infinite multitude of novelty. And so I suppose I'm living a worthwhile narrative in, through that lens, as long as I don't identify with, you know, the identity itself, but perhaps life. You know, I like what Eckhart Tolle says, you know, you're not your personal identity, you're life itself, that which animates your body. And, you know, he talks about the new consciousness being excruciating for, you know, for the mind or the, you know, the psyche that's not ready for it. And I notice in my dreams little bits of, I could only describe it as a twinkling darkness, just kind of being shown to me. And it's kind of the work that I am avoiding, I suppose, in my waking hours, but being sort of gifted these little glimpses in my sleep life, which is ultimately far richer than my waking life.
Mm-hmm. So what work are you avoiding in the daytime?
I suppose diving into my mother issues. I mean, I'm only doing it now because I'm in a way parroting what you're doing and projecting, or at least identifying, you know, parts of my splintered psyche in the pod sphere, and I greatly value what you're doing, because it allows me to recognize parts of myself that are different, but, you know, perhaps similar in some ways, different in others, but that I would otherwise be pretty okay with ignoring completely.
Hmm.
You know, like my mom and I don't have a good relationship. I always felt like she was trying to instill doubt in me, and I had like a keen sense of I don't know. I mean, as a kid, I felt a deep knowing. I felt like an old soul, and I felt like she tried to really get me to doubt that, and she never gave me enough love and always loved my brother more. And so just how these very basic woundings are constantly informing my choices and my behavior is what I'm avoiding, I think.
So that's something that you have only become aware of recently?
No, it's that it's, you know, I tried to flush it and it came back up, you know, and it's about 5 years I wasn't talking to my mom, and, you know, I had my son and then daughter, and I think my son Emmett was 5 or 6 when he met my mom for the first time, so she kind of came back into my life. And under the pretense that we weren't going to talk about our falling out and that we wouldn't, you know, like, drag up the past, because she always takes it as a personal attack of her character and not a, hey, mom, I'm your child and I'm suffering and I need somebody to go over this with.
But do you?
I do, because I don't trust myself to look in the darker corners, or at least have created shields from things that wouldn't surprise me.
Right. So you mean you need her memory?
I don't know that I need her memory, because it would be probably distorted, but, you know, the help of a... I don't know what I need from her, really. That's, I suppose...
Well, that's the question to ask, I think.
I suppose I want her approval, and I never got it.
Yeah, well, that's something else entirely, isn't it? And to identify and separate those two drives in you, this need to resolve something in your own psyche, which may not be a need either, but it's something that is going to get to happen, it's going to have to happen in its own proper time, as part of your individuation process, and, you know, what you can do to facilitate that on the one hand, and how it pertains to your mother, and then on the other hand, this childhood wound that is unhealed. And so then, I mean, something similar happening, you know, with my brother, and I've been working on this piece, and initially when I was trying to get it actually out there, I wanted not just to do it, write it all down, the true story, but get it out there so that it would actually be like an act of war, and my brother would actually have to read it in The Guardian, and you know, this is, I wasn't super gung-ho about this or anything, but I did think that might be kind of cool.
Yeah, I love to shove people's face in their shit, man, and I don't know why I have that tendency.
Well, it's natural enough, and you know, if we write or if we're driven to do stuff creatively at all, then there's going to be an element of revenge in there, I think, always. If we're trying to get attention or get noticed, then it's driven by some sort of wound, so we're actually trying to get back at. So in a way, you could say this was me really stripping things bare, but the way that I justify this or rationalize it to myself was that there is a part of me that does need this. It does need my mother to see what she didn't see then, which was that my brother was bullying me and abusing me and all the rest of it. And she was too drunk or too out of it to really notice it. My brother was too cunning and tricky. Combination of these factors, it continued. And it's continued all through to the present day. He's still bullying and all the rest of it. So it's still this, you know, really tangled, charged mess of psychic family dynamics, which is just so, you know, unpleasant to be in the midst of, because you just get triggered at every turn. So then I'm going to enact this now, so that part of me gets what it needs, knowing that I don't need that now.
And that being what again? The revenge?
Well, forcing them to look at and admit, own up to what they wouldn't when I was a child, to bring it to an end. But the point is that there's something in that, but not if it's done to actually resolve anything. It's like an enactment. To really be true as an enactment, we have to be neutral. If we're identifying with the persona, the role that we're playing, it's not an enactment. We're actually in the circle, getting triggered and being driven by our wounds and all the rest of it. So as long as we're doing it because we think we actually need it, even if I'm rationalizing it by saying, well, no, it's not me, but it's a part of me, then I'm still caught. I'm still, you know, being triggered, and I'm still doing this out of compulsion, even if it's subtler. Because the part of you that needs or that wants approval from your mother, she can't give it to. It's too late.
Yeah, you're right.
But you can. You can give that to that part of yourself. And so recognizing the wound, identifying the cause of it, which is your mother, and then thereby correcting your mother's raging egomania, which harmed you so badly as a child, by not by compensating, but by cancelling it out, by being the other way yourself, by being everything that she wasn't for your kids, I guess, would also be a big part of it, but for that child in you most of all. So then that part gets healed, and then you go to your mother, because then there's no more want for approval. There's just that the necessity of some sort of resolution in your own psyche, which is already, that would already be in motion. So going to your mother wouldn't be to resolve it either, but it would be just, okay, now I'm going to sit with my mother from this place of knowing that she is this way, that I can't trust her, that she's not my ally, that she's not my friend. But she's, you know, there's no reason to blame her either, because, you know, whatever she did to me was done to her in some way. She was just passing on the wound unconsciously. And you don't need her to see any of this. But on the other hand, she will see it if you're in that knowing. Without you having to say anything, she will experience some shift in you. And then she will actually want to talk about these things, probably. She will have this unconscious sense that something has changed and it will make her uncomfortable. And but it won't matter anyway. That's kind of the second. I mean, I'm actually talking about myself now because I'm going back to England and I'm going to see my mother. And I really don't want to be triggered if I can help it. And a big part of that is just not going there with any agenda. But it's sort of chicken or an egg thing, you know. I'm letting go of the agenda so that I can integrate this part of myself. But I need to integrate this thing and heal this wound in myself in order to really let go of my agenda, so that they go hand in hand. And I don't expect to be fully clear by the time I get to England, but as close as I can be to that neutral space where it doesn't matter what my mother says or how she is, because she's just a woman. That's all she is. Now, she's not my friend. She's not really my mother in the sense, because I don't need her to be a mother. So, all right, she is biologically my mother. But in terms of if I no longer have any personal investment in her as a mother, because I'm no longer trying to get what I didn't get as a child. She's not really my mother anymore either, really. Not, you know, from a sorceress point of view, it's like Jesus saying to Mary, woman, who are you? I don't know you.
Yeah, you know, for a long time, I've felt like my healing has been contingent upon my mom's owning up to, or at least looking at, and not, you know, like the things that she did to hurt me. And, you know, I started thinking about that and thinking, okay, well, if she doesn't ever own up to it, then you'll never heal. And I see how I am. I mean, like, it's pretty funny because I pretty much fall instantly in love with any pretty girl I see. And, you know, I just have such this deep longing to be loved by a woman, and you know, the one woman who really loves me, in many ways, is the hardest to be around, and that's Lindsay, the mother of my kids. And you know, I left her, she moved out, she hooked up with her friend, and it's like, what did I expect would happen? And now, you know, I feel even more devastated and lonely, and feel like I'm just kind of making a mess of the good things, quote unquote good things, in my life.
How long ago did you break up?
She moved out on September 11th of this last year.
I thought you said you left her.
Yeah, that's the thing, is she got a place with a friend, and so I was married to her for 7 years, and even 3 years into the marriage, we weren't sure, you know, we were going to make it. And, you know, I was in a band on a major label trying to be a somebody, and met her, and we eloped and found ourselves with child, you know, a year and a half into being married. And I voiced my discontent for a long time, feeling... I don't know, man. Feeling trapped and feeling like she wanted to keep me for herself, like a bird in a cage, and that she wasn't really aware or perceptive of the deep discontent within me. And I'm not sure how clean my desire to be separate from her is. I really don't. I'm very skeptical of it, because the three people I am the biggest somebody in the world to are, you know, she and my kids. And yet it's somehow not good enough, or she complicates my life or stresses me out, and you know, all these projections.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we're still married, and she runs off after singing this soulmate tune for 7 years. You know, there's only one soulmate for me in the world. And you know, us separating and her kind of running to the next convenient thing to deal with the pain and the loss, or at least that's my interpretation of it.
You mean into another relationship?
Yeah, And you know, she had sex with this guy, and you know, I it's funny, you know, I didn't lose my virginity till I was 18, and I've had two sexual partners in my whole life, and you know, one being with my first girlfriend, and I think we had sex maybe two or three times, and so there's all this sex stuff tangled up in it where, you know, I feel like she's had more sexual partners, and there's this, you know, ego tendency to want to, you know, go out and screw chicks, and you know, I don't know, man. I feel like I'm swimming in a lot of shit, and you know, I feel like she one-upped me, and that's such a stupid way of looking at it.
Well, sure, but it's not, you know, it's not your rational self that's experiencing it that way. It's that wounded child again. It'll be sourced in some pattern in your childhood. Something, you know, it's all hardwired to that first relationship with your mother, isn't it? One way or another.
Yeah, she didn't hold me enough, and yada yada, and you know, it's like I feel like I've thrown away the best thing that I have, which is, you know, well, I think my kids are the best thing I have going for me in my life, but they're not mine to have going for me. You know what I mean?
No. Well, and neither is the relationship. It was never yours either. So, I mean, if you decide that a relationship isn't giving you what you want, then you get to decide whether to be in that relationship or not, then you're not understanding the nature of the relationship, because it's not about you.
Yeah.
Being a somebody for your wife and kids is not what it's about either. You know, that just turns the whole thing into an awful burden. The end, because you know, that's like your mother investing in her kids and favoring one over the other. That's when you bring the ego, the personal agendas to raising a family, then that's sustaining, you know, this false narrative that has created this hellish world that we live in. Because it's like, it's one thing to invest in silly, shallow dreams of being a movie star or a rock and roll superstar or what have you, but to invest that stuff into other human beings, most of all, you know, children, who are actually going to be formed and shaped and burdened by those investments. That's when you really get into a messy situation, which is just the potential for regret and self-recrimination is enormous.
What was it that you said like a week or two ago, that Jung said that the most dangerous thing is
is the unlived life of the parent?
That's right, man. And I mean, that brought me to my knees, man. I was just like, oh shit. And you know, I suppose there's this one part of me that sees the dissolution of my family that I grew up in over the years. And, you know, we all want to give our kids what we didn't have. And there's such an assumption of value in that. And suppose we get what we need. And I'm so busy making a judgment value that, you know, trying to protect my son and my daughter from the hurt that I know is that this is causing them. But ultimately feeling the potential for me to be a better parent in the absence of that marriage. I don't know if that's true or not.
How would you be a better parent by not being a parent?
By not being married, rather?
Okay, so by being a single parent.
Right. Well, there was a great tendency with Lindsay and me to kind of wait for the other person to respond to the needs of the kids, and a kind of general escapism and apathy, where we'd each be sitting at our respective computers, you know, doing email and Facebook and all that bullshit, while the kids are, you know, fighting or, you know, down the hall, and, you know, she's waiting for me to get up, I'm waiting for her to get up. In the absence of that other person, you know, it's like I realize it's all on me when I have the kids, and so I step up to a degree and own the role in a way that I don't.
So why not take that knowing into the relationship and take full responsibility as if you were the only parent, even when you're not? Because it sounds to me like it's a power play, really. So then you're mixing up the sexual stroke romantic relationship with your partner with the relationship between the two of you as mother and father, and they don't mix. I mean, once you become a parent, there isn't really any room for romance, because that's just a big illusion anyway.
Yeah, and I see when our romantic life has been in a good place, it's been at the expense of the kids.
Well, and good in what way? Because it made you feel good?
Oh, that's a great question. I don't know.
Well, you know, I'm 42 and I haven't had kids, and I've just reached a point last year where I realized, well, wait a minute, actually, I don't want kids. I've wanted to have a kid my whole life, and when I was still a virgin, I thought I wanted to have a kid. Why? I don't know. Now I'm in a place, it's not that I, as in, don't want a kid, like, no way, but as in, this is definitely nothing I'm going to volunteer for. There's something, if it happens, then, well, absolutely awesome. It'll probably be, you know, it'll finish me off, chances are, so that's fine. But, anyway, that was not exactly where I was going, but part of this kind of shift in my perception, or that is part of a larger shift in my perception, which is that to be in a relationship, what I call alchemical marriage, it is a crucible, it is a microcosm of the whole journey of consciousness, in that we get to be in a space in which something is happening which is awesome and magical and transcendental, but it is so much greater than us for these very reasons, that there's actually nothing we can do to, you know, the more we try and put our hands on it and direct the relationship and get something out of it, the less it can happen. Because that purpose of a relationship, of an alchemical marriage, is, it does transcend our persons. To the extent that what I've come to see, in a sense, the more uncomfortable that relationship is, the richer the potential for letting go, for surrender, for transformation, for letting go of our personal wants and desires, and just surrendering to this greater purpose without fully understanding what it is. Of course, this is contingent on finding and meeting the right partner. But to an extent, I mean, whoever we end up with is the right one, at least for a period of time, and we can override that if we just go after superficial requirements and, you know, find our perfect match on the internet kind of thing. Actually, ironically, my two long-term relationships, I met both of them on the internet, but not by looking. And in both cases, even from the start, it wasn't really what I was looking for in a partner. So I was right from day one. I was like, oh really? This is the one for me? Okay, well, it's not what I was looking for. I'd kind of rather have had that girl or this girl, but that's, you know, when you see the evidence of spirit, you know, working its design, and it's irrefutable, the synchronicities and the matches and all the rest of it, then, and the mythic narrative unfolding, then it's easy to surrender to that. And so I've been lucky in that way, or whether it's luck or something else, but I've ended up in a marriage now where it doesn't actually matter really to me very much how well we get along, or how much we enjoy each other, or how much sex we have, or how close we feel, or how much I'm able to be or express love for her. None of that really matters, Jesse, because I know that we were brought together for some purpose, and that's happening. It's just happening, and you know, as long as I'm not taking out my shit on this person, or you know, actually abusing them, then I don't feel any sense of duty in terms of being something. Like, I've got to be a certain sort of husband, and I don't. We don't have kids. We do have a cat, and so that's, you know, a little small version of the similar thing of like, I am acutely aware of how I don't appreciate my cat as much as I might, and he annoys me when he wakes me up. I shut him out of the bedroom this morning, and I thought, well, you know, this isn't me opening and softening, this is me closing, and because I don't want my cat to bug me, and it underlined this sense of I really don't think I'm ready to have kids, because I'm too selfish. But you already do have kids, and there's nothing you can do about that to change that. So you've already embarked upon an alchemical marriage, whether you know it or not. And you're now intrinsically and permanently part of that system that you've helped bring about. Doesn't matter if you're on at the other side of the planet. The four of you are all linked together psychically and energetically. So whatever you do affects them, and whatever they do affects you. You're entangled. So then, to be absent in order to be a better parent, to try and separate yourself from the system in order to function better within the system, is sort of a contradiction. It sounds to me more like you're saying, I just want to be more comfortable and be able to do what I want to do.
Yeah, it's pretty much what it boils down to. You know, like, I'm a selfish person with kids. That's the difference, you know? It's like, yeah, man, you know, it's tough, because I feel like I create these kind of false dichotomies, these either-or situations, and these, you know, either just be the family man, or be the musician, or, you know, these attempts to create an identity that I can then say is the right choice, and I'm doing the right thing, because right and wrong was a very black and white thing in my upbringing. And as my morals and values have really become really gray, in this idea of non-judgment and the divine being an allower, I don't even know where I'm going with this. I feel like it's just shit, so I'll leave it there. I don't know. Yeah, I'm selfish, man, and I want to be a rock star, and I want women to love me, and I want my mom to say, oh, how did I miss how great he was, and it's all shit, man.
So what does that leave?
Here and now? My breath?
Because being is nothing that you need to do, is it? It's not dependent on being something, much less somebody, because you can't help but be. So the more that you add to that, the more you turn being into doing. So the further you get from being, the more you have a sense of what you want to be, the less honest you get to be about what you are. Because what you are is not what you want to be. What you are is what you are.
Thanks, man. I needed to hear that.
But so you have a knowing or at least an intuition, which isn't the same thing, that you are much greater than you know, that you're tuned into this very narrow bandwidth, and that there's a whole other spectrum of being that you're not able to experience.
True.
But as I said, if that's true, then it's not your business to try and access or claim that greater portion of being. It's the only thing you get to do is clear up a space for that. It's just let go of all of your doings and be what you are in order to clear out all the clutter of your doings so that that greater portion of your being can have that space that you've been using for yourself in order to be somebody.
Yeah, that's wise. Yeah, I appreciate your insights, bro, and I appreciate your taking the time to talk with me, because I know you're busy, and you know you're
not really.
I'm sorry.
I'm not really. I mean, I'm busy because I want to be busy, and connecting is what I'm doing. You know what I'm busy doing, and so.
Do you want to talk about Sweta a little? Because
I was just going to say that what I've been doing, or with you, or being for you, hopefully a bit of both, is to give you a taste of Sweta, and it seems like you would be very at home, Sweta.
Yeah, I've been avoiding it for a long time, to be honest, because, as I mentioned in the last podcast, I'll be honest, man, I'm definitely, there's a part of me that's threatened by your grasp on things, and that it's easier to stay away from it's easier to avoid looking at parts of myself if I don't associate myself with people who are attuned to that sort of thing, and so I've noticed my own sort of self-sabotaging, you know, kind of looking the other way with the whole Sweta thing, because I've been trying to do this whole, like, magician thing, and, you know, somehow it's just not really worked for me, man. I'm just, like, way too much of a mess to be able to, and, you know, our short little discussion on the will and the personal will being, you know, free will being an illusion, and kind of coming to terms with that everything I do kind of goes to shit.
Well, I think you're fortunate in that regard, then.
Fortunate?
Not so much that everything you do turns to shit, although that can be a good fortune too, but that you haven't been able to get it together enough to do the magician thing.
Yeah, I was throwing around the whole, like, mystery school thing for a while, but it really reinforces my desire to control it.
Yeah, it's at odds with the pathless path,
yes,
of surrender. But it's, for some people, it's a necessary way to get to that place. For me, it certainly was, and for most people that I interact with, if not everyone really, and everyone at Sweta, more or less, with a couple of exceptions, has come to Sweta via the sorcerer's path. It's funny, I brought this up with Joe Mazzini, who I interviewed for Water yesterday, and brought up this thing in Castaneda where, have you read the books, by the way?
I haven't.
Well, that might be a good segue for you between your magical failed aspirations and Sweta, or, you know, whatever, your own Sweta process, might be reading Castaneda, because they are, you know, you know, I've talked a lot about Second Matrix, and, you know, maybe this for another conversation we could have another time, but I was thinking today, listening to your chat with Magus Michael, who, I don't know, do you know that he's in Sweta?
I do, man.
You know?
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Yeah, well, he's changed a lot since that interview with you, by the way.
Really?
Even his voice has changed. But anyway, I was talking about Crowley, and I had the thought, well, in terms of the second Matrix, Crowley is really like the architect, you know, in Matrix Reloaded. He's like that guy. He's like the one person most instrumental in the construction of what I've termed the second Matrix would be Crowley. Because it's much more than just the red ice memes of conspiracies and all the different elements that we're very familiar with. It's the whole put your hands on your awakening thing, which leads to what I believe is a false awakening, a second Matrix. And so Castaneda is actually, although those books are a kind of part of the second Matrix too, in this, for the simple fact that they're written by somebody who never quite got it, I don't think, or if he did get it, it was, you know, too late for it to... It is in the books, but you have to kind of read between the lines, but they're kind of presented as a personal journey towards freedom. So it's the stick and the carrot again. Everything that Castaneda writes about in The Sorcerer's Path, even though there are not doings there, it's not all doings. It's a lot of it is about not doing, but it does have the surrender virus in there. But essentially, it's framed in this very dramatic kind of narrative of an ordinary guy becoming a sorcerer, and how exciting and how glamorous that is. Well, it's very scary too. So they are tainted, but they are as close to testimonials, you know, that are part of the second Matrix thing, that do show the crack. They do show that it is just a second Matrix. And this is actually, Don Juan actually says this to Kars very clearly, that the path of sorcery is a dead end, because the only function that it has is to provide us with an alternate interpretation of reality to juxtapose consensus reality with or against, and then we can slip between the two. Because if we see that there's another alternative just as real, another interpretation just as real as the consensus, then we can really let go of the interpretation that we've grown up with.
Right, which is
but sorcery in itself, if we just go from one interpretation to the other and say, oh, it's not that way, it's this way, then we just end up in a bigger matrix, thinking that we're sorcerers, so now we're above all that. So, but the surrender comes in when you're able to let go, even of the new interpretation, knowing that real attainment, real enlightenment, isn't a doing. It isn't an achievement. It's
that's a flow.
It's a happening, and it's always happening, and we don't get there by trying. We don't get there by will. That's the final subterfuge of the ego. The final insistence is, I want enlightenment my way. I want enlightenment, yes, but I want credit for it.
Yeah.
I'm the one who's done it, and that prevents us. That's the final barrier. If we can't let go of doing our own enlightenment, then we never get to be enlightened.
You know, on the topic real quick of being the one, I really resonated with what you said about a lady that he worked with, who said that she felt like she was the last person alive. That's been my experience of the one, is not the savior, but the last one, and everybody's waiting for me, and somehow it's all my fault.
The Alpha and the Omega. The first shall be the last. It's the price of specialness. The bigger the carrot, the bigger the whip. If you want to be, you know, the chosen one, then you get to be, you know, the last man on earth.
Yeah. Are you familiar with Scott Walker, the singer-songwriter?
No.
I watched a documentary of his. I know nothing about him, but he was an American singer who was famous in England in the 60s. I forget the name of the band he was in, but Scott Walker ended up kind of going off and doing his own thing, and now he makes these really eerie records. They're closest thing I could describe them to is like music from the unconscious, and it's he has this song called Jesse, and you know, I'd heard it just after one of my salvia experiences, and it's just loaded with synchronicity and personal meaning. And then it gets to the end, and he keeps repeating the line, I'm the only one left alive, I'm the only one left alive. And it's just like ripping me a new one, and I'm sitting there just like shaking in tears. And so I suppose that seeing myself as special, as being the last one, is yet another, mirage.
Well, it's bringing something into the personal, because if we are all one consciousness, then the experience of being the one is being consciousness, undifferentiated consciousness. And one can access that through psychedelics, but then one drags it down into the personal and says, it's me, oh my God, I'm the only one here. So then it becomes damnation. We're Lucifer plummeting into matter. So we experience the one, and then you experience the other. There's a corresponding reaction to that expansion, as we then contract all the way back into the ego, but with this new awareness, and then that is experienced as damnation. But speaking of Mitch, because I feel like we're probably winding up now, if we've been on 8 minutes.
My bladder agrees.
Okay. Well, I wanted just to mention Mitch briefly, because when I was listening to your podcast, you talked about the dream of the snake.
Ah, yes.
And I began to think of Mitch immediately, because one way that Mitch visits people astrally is by sending his snake. That was after I first met Mitch. I had a dream of a snake, and I told him about it, and he laughed and said that that always happens. That's the way that he knows who his apprentices are or who his friends are. I want to look at that. So you were talking about the dream of the snake, and I was thinking, I wonder if that was Mitch. And immediately afterwards, you mentioned Mitch.
Yeah, man. I for me, the hero's journey and Stan Grof's perinatal matrices are kind of like the roadmap I've been trying to use in my own personal death rebirth. And I feel like I'm still kind of on the threshold of the refusal slash divine intervention and the hero's eventual acceptance of the journey. And hearing you and Mitch talk, and him pretty much just making an open offer to people, I felt like this tension in me, like a recognizing something authentic and kind of squirming in my seat, like but feeling called to it, feeling called to Mitch's energy, and him having come through the through you, and for me gives him more credibility, because to be honest, it's really hard for me to listen to other podcasts anymore because of such the nuts and bolts take on things. And I'll listen to all the interviews you do, even like the one with the movie guy. Even though I feel like a lot of them really only scratch the surface, I still find it to be beneficial. So the last couple interviews you did, what was it, Mitch and Len? I mean, those for me have just really, it becomes harder and harder for me to separate my own narrative from yours. And it almost bothers me, because I see this parroting thing that I become really hypercritical of, because of my own desire to be a really unique somebody. But it really, I just want you to know that I really appreciate what you're doing, what you're being, from the bottom of my heart, at least.
I got that, yeah. Jesse. I got that loud and clear, and thanks. I appreciate you saying it and testifying to it, and it's definitely smoothed my passing, because Warty is going to be the last episode after this one with Joe. I'm hoping to get Neil Kramer on there for the last. We'll see.
Yeah, I love Neil. I got to meet him a few months back. Very great guy.
But yeah, that it just helped confirm it, because it seemed like that, like the meme had taken on a life of its own, really, hearing your podcast. And so it's like, okay, it's a good time to retire again. I like retiring from time to time, as you may have noticed.
Yeah, I've often wanted to just pull the plug on the podcast, because, as I mentioned, it's not clean, but it's the best I can do, the best I can be.
Well, if you're enjoying doing it, then that is very clean energy enjoyment. Okay, it doesn't mean it's not mixed with the desire to be somebody and all that stuff, but the more you just focus on the enjoyment, the less seriously you need to take it, the more clean it is.
Yeah, it's one of the few things that I still enjoy. So I suppose I'll keep it around. And this talk has been a long time coming for me, man. And so, I had this nice little intro reflecting my, playing a host somebody that I left out. But do you want to, I'm sure all the listeners are familiar with your stuff, but I'd love to give you a chance to plug your books and give people links so they can check out more of your stuff.
Oh God, do I have
No, you don't have to. I'll just put them in the show
to?
notes. It's just a courtesy.
Put the show notes up there. Yeah, buy my book, come to my site, join Sweater. You're welcome. All comers are welcome. I encourage you.
Thanks, Jason. I really appreciate your time, bro.
Well, thanks for having me on, Jesse. It's good to finally meet.
Yeah, man, and thanks for recording for us too. Clearly, I have my shit together.
Yeah, it's in the can.
I thank you very much.
No problem.
I'll talk to you soon, okay?
All right, Jesse.
All right, love it.